Yes, that's right. Yeah, Teresa points out that when Barak demands that Deborah go with her, or he's not going to go, which is not a very masculine thing to say, she says that a woman will get the glory. And the assumption probably he had, and maybe others, is what? That it would be Deborah that would get the glory, but that's not what happens. And you can see that in the song, in the praise of Jael. Most blessed of women. Can you think of any other one woman only in the whole Bible of which is that said, which is set up?
Mary.
You know that? Yeah. Interesting that that describes a woman who drove a tent peg through a man's head.
He saved a nation, though.
Mom, look at that.
Yeah, and then that woman that's going to do, that's going to drop the millstone on Abimelech. I mean, yeah. Guys got issues with their heads getting crushed.
That's right. And women doing it to them.
I know, right?
Yeah, that's kind of important. I'm going to bring that up. I think that's part of a picture, really, that is somewhat pervasive in Judges. That is, nobody's doing the right job. And some people step up and do things that are kind of appropriate, maybe sometimes not even appropriate, but they're filling a hole, and the hole is the problem.
So Marty, what do you think about Deborah not being mentioned in Hebrews 11, but Barak is?
Well, he's the one that led into the battle.
Okay.
He's the one that fought it. You'll see in her praise of him, in fact, in her own poem, she says that, you know, Deborah should be leading in celebration, exclamation point, or singing, and Barak should be leading away the captives, exclamation point. And I think there's a statement about the proper role of men and women, especially with regard to warfare. And if you look at the list, you know, those four or five, six names, if you count David and Samuel, you know, are about putting to flight armies of the aliens, and, you know, out of weakness we're made strong, and things like that, which I think does apply, at least in that case, to military victories. Okay, well, we're halfway done the lesson, just in precursor comments here. So if y'all are ready, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And I'm sorry I'm so dependent on, let's see, I don't want to do that. I want to use this whole screen here. All right, working? Just a thumbs up will work. Oh, and I should, yeah, and then, so that changes everything. I got to readjust my windows here for a second. It's not too bad. All right, if it's the 27th of July, we should be on either five or four judges, however you want to count them. If you want to count Deborah instead of Barak or Barak instead of Deborah, that would be four. But that's what we're going to cover tonight. And you remember from the movie, I hope you watched it. Maybe you can watch it again. It's only, as we said before, 7.5 minutes. Last week we covered this first little introduction, which is kind of mirrored by this last section over here, which are those two stories. And we'll take two lessons on chapters 17 and 18. But remember that we had this list of the conquest. It went from south to north and from bad to good. I'm sorry, good to bad, right? You remember that? Starting with Judah doing the best and ended with really Dan, who was kind of in the south but ended up kind of being booted all the way to the north. And then we had Joshua died, at least for the first time in the book. And then we had this cycle of sins and all of that. And then there's a list of how they broke the covenant. And then in chapter 3, there's a list of all the nations that remained to test them. And that's an ominous, then you, before you go to the commercial break, you know something bad's going to happen. Because here are all these nations left to test them. And then that's what starts in those next stories. So tonight, our mission, should we decide to accept it, is the pretty good judges, right? At least the way the Bible Project describes it. Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar we'll cover, and then Deborah and Barak. So we'll cover that section of the book in this part of the thing. I just want to remind you where the tribes are. I think every tribe is listed at least once in this lesson, somehow or another. So it's good to know where they are. And the judges come from different areas, as well as the mention of the tribes in chapter 5 and how they did or did not support Barak in the battle against Jabin and Sisera. Okay, so you want to call these out or put them in the chat, I'd appreciate if you just call them out. That'd be great. Who's kind of the dominant tribe down here in the bottom area now?
Judah.
And who's with them? Their brother.
Simeon.
Yeah, Simeon. I read Danny's lips. Yeah. So Simeon. And then who's the tribe that borders with Judah, actually with Jerusalem on the south border and Bethel on the north border? What tribe would that be?
Benjamin.
Which plays predominant in, at least in some of tonight's lesson. And who's over there beside Benjamin? I think that's Dan, but I think we did Ephraim next. It's the next one. Dan, and then Dan, of course, right. North. And then Ephraim. And what do we say is the country of Ephraim?
Hill country.
Yeah, well, I mean, how would we describe it? The hill country or the pill country, right? They're kind of a little obstinate. They ended up being a little bit dominant and rebellious over time. And then there's a big, big land area that actually is a western version.
So you're saying they're hillbillies.
I'm saying they're hillbillies, right. In fact, we'll find that. And they're obstinate hillbillies. Worse. Uh-oh. And so Deborah, was judging in Mount or the hill country of Ephraim. That's a common phrase. All right, next tribe up to the north, big area.
Are you not talking about Manasseh, right?
I am talking about Manasseh, and that's Manasseh west, and then Manasseh east is over on the other side in the area of the Bashan. And then what are the other two tribes over here in the east?
Gad and Reuben.
Gad and Reuben. And I just want to mention this, it's not on the list, but there's a region that kind of runs all through here. What's that area? And we're going to, I think it's mentioned in the poem tonight. We just need to know that. What's that region called often?
Gilead.
Gilead, right. And some of the tribes come from Maker, which we don't know where that is. Machir. That seems like in the lineage of Manasseh. So somewhere in here is going to be the place called Maker, which we'll know about. And you know that Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph, so they're grandsons of Israel, not sons of Israel. Okay, keep on going. This is a very flat area where chariots do very well. What's that called? Actually, and cars would do well there. There's actually a real nice highway today that rides right down through there. Issachar. Yes.
Issachar.
Yeah, that's right. And then the next one over. Just have to remember that one. Maybe you can think of a way to do it. Zebulun. It's Z. The last thing you think of, I guess, is Z. And then Asher by the sea, which will be mentioned today as far as the sea goes. And then in this area right here, this is kind of important, Naphtali or Naphtali, however you want to say that. And notice Hazor. That'll be prominent in our lesson. And Kedesh, which I've covered up. I could unanimate, I guess, but I can't actually. So anyway, that's up there. Bethel is going to be down here, where in the pill country of Ephraim. That's where Deborah is working. You'll notice Megiddo here, and near Megiddo is Taanach, which is where Deborah's song says the battle took place. Mount Tabor is important for tonight's lesson. So that's our geography. We really need it all tonight to do this reading, okay? All right, let's start with Judges 3. We left off last week at the end of verse of chapter 3, 1 through 6, where the list of the nations, which included the stalactites and the stalagmites and others who occupied the land. I'm just kidding. That's a joke. Nobody's laughing. I thought that was pretty funny.
Anyway, they're all mute.
Yeah, the Hivites and then Jebusites. Remember those people because they're important for Jerusalem. All right, so the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and Asherahs. Now, Emily had a question last week about that Baal worship somehow wasn't prominent until Jezebel or Ahab and Elijah. But that's really I think what happened in that particular regime in the northern tribes, which is a long time later, hundreds of years later, is that I think the prophets of Baal ate at Jezebel's table, is the way that's described. So there's a nationalization of the religion and a support from the actual king. But the Baals have been there forever. In fact, you remember one of the judges is going to be named Jerob Baal, which is let Baal contend. Why? Because Baal worship was in his father's house, and he had to tear down the idol overnight. So it's a pretty prominent thing. Remember, too, that Baals are plural. That is, they're localized lords, if you will, whatever that word means, which are characterized in nations, cities, of tribes, and the cultures and civilizations around them. Now, therefore, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the king and the children of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, remember, Lord is Yahweh, capital letters there, the Lord raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel who delivered them. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, which either means it's his nephew or a really younger brother, depending on whose father Kenaz is. So Caleb's father was not Kenaz, so it makes more sense that it was his nephew. All right, but okay, so Caleb's brother is Kenaz, maybe that Othniel was his nephew. The Spirit of the Lord, I want you to look for that. Is there, in the lesson tonight, see if the Spirit of the Lord empowers anybody else in this lesson tonight. It will come up later in the book, right? You'll see that. But watch for that. And there may be some hint there as to whether God actually is enabling these particular things that they do, or is he just using the man's initiative, courage, maybe even poorly motivated actions to deliver Israel. But in any case, watch for that. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon me, judged Israel. He went out to war. And Yahweh delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, the king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. He prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. How many times could they put that word in the text? So the land had rest for 40 years. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. So I don't know what more to say about that. One version of the meaning of his name is the Lion of God. He seems to be from the tribe of Judah, being Caleb's son. That makes sense, and he's kind of a lion, maybe the kingly tribe. I don't really know. Anyway, so that was good for 40 years. And remember, I don't know that we can add the next 18 years. You see, there's 40 years here. Can't find my pen here. 40 years here, and there's 18 years here. So I don't know that you can add them linearly. Perhaps you can early on. But we're going to get to almost 100 years past Joshua by the time we get to Deborah. Barak. Anyway, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab. Y'all remember where Moab was? I didn't point it out, but here's Moab and here is Ammon. Remember, those are the two sons of
Lot.
Lot by incest, by his daughters. And so they're going to show up. And they're kind of brethren, and they kind of didn't fight them when they were coming up into the promised land up the eastern side of the Jordan Valley here. They did deal with the Amorites. Remember Sion and Og? That was big. That was Moses' really big battle defeat. Maybe the basis on which he asked Jehovah, hey, I'm on a roll. Let me take them on into the land. God said, no, you know why you can't do that. And don't bring it up again. That was in Deuteronomy. But anyway, the Amorites are in this area just over the Jordan. And probably on both sides, really, but Moab and Ammon. So so here's where we are. Moab, because they had done evil, and he gathered with him Ammon and Amalek, the Amalekites. Remember, that's, I think, of the descendants of Esau, if I remember, one of the chieftains. They went and defeated Israel. They took possession of the city of palms. Anybody want to guess what the city of palms is? You probably know.
Jericho.
Most likely Jericho, right. In fact, Deuteronomy refers to Jericho. As the city of palms. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. So just to look back a little bit at Othniel, Cushan-Rishathaim came from way far away, way to the east of them, and from the western part of Mesopotamia. And really, if you look, it was the king of Aram-Naharaim, apparently, is one that is a way that's translated. And you probably know this word Aram. Aramaean is a language, you know, that ended up being kind of the common dialect of all the folks. And it really means, this means Aram, which is probably named after one of Noah's grandsons, the son of Shem. Down here you notice at the bottom. But it's in northwest Mesopotamia, really the eastern part of what would be Syria today. And so the Arameans is another name that comes up in the future of Israel's history, but it's the Syrians. So you get the idea. So that's where they are. But they're from far away. But they come down, and then, of course, somebody from Judah has to deal with that. And that's what Othniel was. So just a little geography there. Okay. Okay, I think we've read this through verse 13. Now start with verse 15. Now we've got this Moabite oppression for 18 years. When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, you see where I am here? The Lord raised up a deliverer for them, and there's kind of the concept of the vindicator, the judge that delivers, rescues on behalf of Jehovah for his people. He raised up Ehud, the son of Gera the Benjamite, a left-handed man. I'll go ahead and stop there because I don't have more detail about it. I think we mentioned this last time. Anybody remember what Benjamin's name was at first? Rachel died giving birth. Bethlehem or Ephrathah or near Bethlehem. What was his name before she died? But she died when she gave birth. What did she name
him? Benny.
That's close. It's Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. And Jacob would not have that. He was not going to. Of course, you remember, Benjamin was the Rachel, you know, had two sons, right? Benjamin, the little guy, the youngest, and he was the favorite and all that. Anyway, so he's not going to be called son of my sorrow. So he's named Benjamin, which apparently means son of my right hand. Interesting. And then the Benjamites turned out to be mostly left-handed. Isn't this fascinating? I think it's, y'all probably all know this already, but the Benjamites are multi-talented, right? They actually, later on, you'll see that among David's special forces, he had a bunch of Benjamites who could sling a stone with both hands and hit a target. And so they were great warriors. We'll see that later in the book during the Civil War, where they seemed to hold off the whole nation of Israel before they're finally taken. So they're quite war heroes. We're going to see that in the story of Deborah as well. But anyway, the Benjamites, mostly left-handed, and that plays into this story somehow important. I'm not exactly sure how, but somehow it's part of the strategy. Anyway, by him, the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Ehud made himself a dagger. It was a double-edged and cubit in length. I'll just mention it comes up some more, too, good background. I think Danny pointed this out, is that this period of history is a transition from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. Did I get that right, Danny? And so,
you're right in there.
So that didn't mean that everybody discovered iron all at the same time. In fact, it seems like the Israelites were the last to discover lots of technologies, right? And so the nations around them seem to have more of the technologies. Well, you learn in, I think, 1 Samuel that the Israelites had to go to Philistia to even sharpen their farm instruments. So much less did they have the ability to make swords or daggers or anything. It's likely this might have been made out of stone, and maybe why it was fairly short. Cubit in length, depending on how tall you were, you know, that'd be maybe this long, but something he could definitely hide under his pants or whatever he wore under his thigh. And so he did that. And he fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. Right thigh, interesting. Why would you put it on your right thigh? Well, maybe because it's easier to get to with your left hand. I don't know if that's possible.
Well, if they'd searched him for weapons, they would have expected the weapon to be on the other thigh.
Yeah, maybe.
On the other side.
Yeah. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Eglon was a very fat man. This really explicit story here. It's going to get worse. And when he finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal. Now, what does Gilgal mean? Y'all remember? Everybody should know. The angel came from Gilgal to Bochim. Weeping came from where? What does it mean? Gilgal. It sounds like what it means.
Rolling away.
Rolling away. That's right. It's rolling away. And it does appear that Gilgal seemed to be a place. I don't know what the stone images are. There's a lot of speculation about that. Is it the stones they collected from the Jordan as they passed over? Because that's where it is. Or is it some idolatry, or is it something else? But it seems to be a place where maybe some of the prophets ended up over time. But anyway, that's for much later. But anyway, he turned back at that place, which is not far from Jericho. And he said, I have a secret message for you, king. And the king said, keep silence. And all who attended him knew that meant get out of here. It's not your business. So they left. Ehud came to him, verse 20. He was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. And then Ehud said, I have a message for you from God for you. So he arose, probably out of respect for the deity that was speaking to him now through Ehud. Ehud reached in, guess what, with his left hand. He took the dagger from his right thigh, thrust it into his belly, and even the hilt went in after the blade, and his entrails came out. And Ehud went out through the porch, apparently maybe a window or some other way out, not the main entrance, and he locked the room before he left. So there we are, we're stuck there. So when he'd gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. Now, why would this guy lock the doors, do you think?
Delay the discovery.
Well, that's why Ehud locked it, but the servants didn't know that. What might they have assumed that was a reason for Eglon to lock the doors, I wonder?
He was going to the bathroom.
Yes, right. And there may have been some other signs that that was going on, because as his entrails came out, I wonder if there was an odor that wafted out of the room. And so they come to the door, and it's locked, and it smells pretty bad. So that might have been pretty good evidence that something else was going on that they did not want to interrupt, right? And so they waited until they were embarrassed, verse 25. And still he hadn't opened the doors. Therefore, they took the key and opened them, and there he was, their master fallen dead on the floor. Isn't that an exciting story? Interesting how the details come together. But Ehud had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the stone images. That means he's gotten to the gotten away down toward the river. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim. Now, I don't know how he got there so quick, but anyway, he did. And he led them. He led them. Ephraimites, the hill country, the rebellious tribe. And he said to them, follow me for the Lord. By the way, he's not an Ephraimite. He's a Benjamite. Remember that? So there's some degree of unity and cooperation we can see, which we're going to see decay over the course of the story of the judges, right? He said, follow me. The Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. So they went down after him. They seized the fords of the Jordan and did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time, they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor, and not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. I've kind of gotten preoccupied with this over the last day or two studying for this, and that is the translation of the Hebrew word for ish. You know what that word ish means in Isha, ish and Isha? Ish is the word for man. You remember that? And in the Garden of Eden, the man called the woman Isha because she was taken out of the Ish, right? So Isha and Ish, those are the words. And in this verse, 29, the word for Ish appears three times. And I've noticed as these translations, English translations, have been in a race to neuter themselves and take any reference to masculinity out of them, that it's interesting to see how many of them try to go ahead and maintain the literal Hebrew word when the word for man or men is actually in the text itself. And so this is the New King James. Obviously, American Standard is very literal and would translate it all three. But if you happen to be looking at your New American Standard or your ESV or your NIV, notice that they either have only two times they say men or only one. But nearly all will have one reference. So they'll say about 10,000 of the people of Moab or something like that, just in their attempt to, neuter the language. But anyway, so that's a preoccupation and a hobby and probably not healthy one that I have. I'm just confessing that to you. But it does play into the story of Deborah and Barak and the way the story is described. I think there's more going on in the story than we first think with regard to the roles of men and women. We tend to think it's somehow supporting the active leadership, aggressive role of women. The story itself, if you look at it in terms of the language and the details and the way the story is told, it actually is doing the opposite, but we'll get to that in a minute. But as a preface, I'll just say, we're going to watch for the translation of the word man or men, and if the word ish, is used, we'll see, we'll notice whether it's in the text or not. Again, it also gives me an opportunity to bash the ESV, so I enjoy that as well. Okay. I hope y'all are laughing. No one seems, it's like, Lakita, are you awake? Oh, sorry. Thank you for moving there. Okay. All right.
Marty, just if I could throw you off
you muted yourself and you threw yourself off there.
No, I was reading some of the archaeology on Jericho, and especially about there was an Iron Age building found at Jericho, and I had never really read or gotten the details on it, but read some in the last week or so. And, you know, based on what was excavated, there is reason to think that this might have been the Moab Palace or
Moab. Yeah.
So
here's Moab over here, and apparently he became strong enough that he established a kind of a fortress here where he could collect tribute then from, and you remember Bethel is the southern border of Ephraim, so from Ephraim here, and then of course the guy from Benjamin, which is, you know, in here, remember Benjamin is between Bethel and Jerusalem, so Ehud's from here, so they're paying tribute there, and what happens is when he escapes, he seems to run down here, and then they block off the fords of the Jordan, the only places you can get across. So when the Moabites try to get back, they're outnumbered there, and that's how he destroys them. And that's the way they are, take the military power is taken out, basically driven back. I mean, obviously did not conquer Moab or anything like that, but they drove him out of the land, and that gave them peace. So that's kind of where that story takes place. And we'll cover Shamgar quickly. After him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad. He also delivered Israel. Okay, so there you go. And thanks to Nate for the artwork there. And you can buy that book that has this and many other exciting stories, illustrated stories from the book of Judges and other parts of the Bible, the reference there, at blurb.com. But you can see Shamgar. There's several other kind of cool pictures. We don't know much about Shamgar. If I had to guess, I would have guessed he was Judah or Benjamin or maybe potentially Dan or something, only because he killed Philistines. But we find the Philistines in other parts. I mean, they ended up killing, you remember, Saul and Jonathan way up at Bethshean, where they put Saul's body. That's way up to the north. But that's way in the future, right? But now I thought he would be down there. One of the reasons he's associated with one of the northern tribes, like maybe Naphtali or Issachar, is that he's mentioned in the Song of Deborah in the days of Shamgar. And kind of maybe that somehow associates him with Deborah and Barak. I don't really know, but it doesn't really say what tribe he's from. But if I had to guess, I would guess one of those southern tribes, but often he's labeled as being associated with Deborah or Barak. Either Ephraim or Issachar or Naphtali, one of those tribes. So I don't know. All right, group time. And we're going to go for about 5 minutes. Open your Bibles up to Judges 4 and 5 before we dive into the story. And all I want you to do, it won't take very long, is find all the women that are listed in that chapter and kind of quickly try to list the descriptive phrases about them, okay? Can you all remember this assignment, or do I need to copy it into the chat? I can do that. But anyway, just list all the women and put the phrases about them. I think you can do it, that are in the both chapters. And either don't write out what all the words they said. Just kind of describe their actions. All right. Are we good with that? All right. So I'm going to stop sharing so I can find the controls more easily. And then I'm going to do breakout rooms. And I think we'll go with maybe five. And that'd be about four participants per room. Is everybody ready? I'm opening all the rooms, and I will call you back in about 5 minutes. Actually, in 4 minutes, and then you'll get a 1 minute warning. Thanks. Everybody ready? Yeah, pretty clever thing. We didn't mention this, but I'll say to whoever's back. Did the Spirit of Jehovah come upon Ehud to make him do all that? Did you notice that? Any reference to the Spirit of the Lord or Spirit of Jehovah?
I don't think so.
Empowering or informing or protecting Ehud? No, I don't think so. Nor is that said of Shamgar either. I don't know what to make of that, but it's interesting to observe the things that the Spirit of the Lord enables people to do. One thing is pretty clear, while we're just waiting for everybody to come back in, is that the Spirit of Jehovah doesn't help their characters at all. And you can see that most clearly in Samson. Just because the Spirit of the Lord comes upon somebody and they do some amazing, miraculous thing in the sense of power or strength or vengeance or whatever, that does not mean that God approves of their character, nor does it seem to help their character at all, even even though they've experienced that process.
Marty, you know, Jim Jonas, when he did a class on the Holy Spirit, that's, he started those Old Testament examples, and he just very well made that exact point you're talking about, not helping their character necessarily.
Yeah, God still leaves us to make choices and to be accountable voluntarily or not, and so that's important to know. All right, thank you all for working on that. I'm assuming everyone's back. You can go off mute. Let's list whom you found. All the women you found, and if you can, briefly give a description. So maybe each group name one. I think we've got enough for all the groups to name one. Judges 4 and 5.
I'll go with the easy one, Deborah.
Oh, good job. Yeah, and what? How is she described? She's described several times.
She's described as a prophetess.
Yes.
And... the wife of Lepidos, and she was one of the judges.
Yep, she says she's judging. In fact, he uses two verbs to describe her judging. One is our word shofat, or shofat, or whatever it is, that is the word for God raising up a judge. But there's another word used for what she did, too. Yep. How else is she described in the poem?
Prophetess.
Yeah, well, that's in chapter 4. That's the first word used to describe her, but in the poem, she's described especially. The villages were deserted, and things were really terrible until I, Deborah, what? What is she described?
Mother in Israel.
A mother in Israel. That's, and by the way, she wrote that. It's kind of an insight into how she looks at herself, I think. Okay. Now, who else? Who else is a prominent woman in these stories?
Jael.
Yes, Jael. How's she described?
I Heber the Kenite.
Yeah, at least twice that's the description of her. We saw the Kenites before. Remember, they're the descendants of Jethro. They were mentioned in chapter 1. And it seemed odd to me that they were highlighted. But I think, again, is maybe God telling us that there are people not blood Israelites who are just as faithful or more faithful, and they'll show up throughout the Bible history. And it's interesting that if she delivered Israel, she was not an Israelite, as Paula kind of mentioned. She was delivered them, but she was not an Israelite, but she dwelt among them. It almost appears that there was some kind of a coalition or truce or something with the Canaanites that they had. So that's why the Sisera would try to hide in their tent. He thought of going there. Anyway, too much detail there. All right, so what other women did you find? Any others?
Sisera's mother.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And she's at home worrying about him a little bit, because where is the noise of the chariots, right? I mean, those iron chariots make a lot of noise. And when he comes rumbling home, you probably hear him miles away, the horses' hoofs and everything. And they're just not hearing any of that. And so she doesn't, but she asks them, sorry, some other women. Who else are in that part of the story?
Wise princesses.
Yeah, the princesses, and that Hebrew word means it means just kind of a nobility person, but, you know, it would be her entourage, or I don't know, but anyway, and they kind of concoct a story. We'll read about that, explaining maybe why he's delayed. Nothing to do with losing or anything, but what might have, delayed him after having won the battle. Anybody else? Any other women? There's one other that's kind of subtle, kind of a little bit hidden.
The women that are spoils?
Yes, exactly. And actually the word is translated girl, but it actually is a word that, I think the Hebrew word means a tender love. It means these men, you know, a tender love or two is actually the way the translation is. So it's not exactly like they've fallen in love. That's not the point. But they found each of them a dainty girl or something to take advantage of, I think, is the idea. Yes, that's the picture. Ironically, you know, and I'll go ahead and cover this while we're thinking about it, she's imagining Sisera and his men abusing women when actually what had already happened.
Who had killed? Sisera is dead.
By whom? By whom?
Jael.
By a woman. You see how that's kind of upside down? They're imagining the men abusing the women out of the spoils of victory, but what had actually happened is a woman had killed Sisera, her son. So interesting.
And by the way, Marty, the Spirit of the Lord had not come on Jael. I read through that twice say that. However, she was very clever to use relationships to be able to entreat him into the tent for safety. Yeah. And, I mean, how marvelous is that?
Yeah, and I'll speculate a little bit more. You probably know. The Kenites, you learn from Jeremiah 35, dwelt in tents partly maybe because they acknowledged that they didn't own the land, even though it turns out the Kenites were in the land back in the time of Abraham, so they were kind of predecessors. But anyway, forget all that. But they were actually dwelt in tents, kind of, and not in cities, not in houses. They didn't build permanent dwellings, I think, to acknowledge that they were really not residents. It was not their land. They were not Israelites. They were the children of promise. So they dwelt in tents. Well, who do you think set up the tents everywhere they went? And who do you think nailed the stakes back in when the wind blew them over, you know, that kind of thing?
We discussed that in our group. The women did it.
Yeah, of course. And so I suspect she was pretty handy with a mallet and a spike or whatever they used as tents. And so not only did she use a deceptive type hospitality, she used the tools that she had at hand. All the women are experts in JL and Deborah and those kinds. But anyway, we'll read the story. All right, let me share my screen again. And let's read through the story and see what we can learn from it. Okay. All right, so there we are. So Judges 4, when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Hazor is a really neat place to visit. It's way in the north, you know, but it's just layers and layers of civilizations and a pretty, pretty interesting, lot of archaeology there. The commander of the army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. Hagoyim is the plural term that really just means peoples. And when you see the word Gentiles in the Old Testament, that's just that word. So Harosheth is probably a real place, but it's Harosheth, which is a city of the peoples, or the Gentiles. It's not clear where that is. One thought is that it's somewhere along the Carmel Range, where there's an opening about a mile wide where chariots could go in and out and come out onto the plain of Har Megiddon, you know, that Megiddo Valley there, Jezreel Valley, I mean, and where they could operate on a flat plain. You remember we already read in chapter 1 that Judah had trouble with these. They could take the mountains. They were good at that, but they couldn't handle the plains because the Canaanites had chariots. And so here we're again against that, but now up into the north instead of the south. And again, they're iron. Iron Age, again, Israelites way behind. And we'll see in the poem that not a spear or shield was found among whatever it was, 40,000 or something in Israel. So the chariots were not just chariots with horses, which the Israelites didn't have either. Shooting arrows and bows and spears, which the Israelites didn't have either. But they were running over more or less unarmed people. That would be the kind of the way the battle would be fought if you were down in the plain, right? Deborah, verse 4, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah. I doubt if it was called that at the time. But you know how these places get called by their names that they're going to get after the historical events occur. Anyway. Or maybe she had a shingle, right? The palm of Deborah. So if you're going to find her, you know, this is my office if you need my help. I don't know. I don't think so. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. I'll mention to you that these are two different words. I have it on another chart. I'll just wait. But judging Israel, that's our word, which we recognize, Shaphat or whatever it is, that is the typical deliverer word, right? God raised up judges. But judgment here is a different word. Slightly, it's close. It's a derivative, but it means a verdict. So if you had a hard decision, you come up. And she apparently, as a prophetess, right, she could do that with some help from the Lord, right? It was done by inspiration. So whatever she said, you could trust it because it had more than just her wisdom behind it. It actually had the wisdom of God. And I think that when she speaks to Barak, she's speaking with that same authority. She says, hasn't the Lord, hasn't Yahweh said this to you? And she sent and called for Barak, or Barak, or whatever you want to call him, the son of Abinoam from Kedesh and Naphtali. You remember our map, Kedesh is way up to the north of Ephraim, the hill country of Ephraim where she is. And she calls him down there and says, hey, what are you doing? Hasn't the Lord of God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops? And by the way, that literal term there is to just means to draw toward. And it's the actual, I'm sorry, I can never find my, the word troops there means to draw toward. And it's the same word as what God was going to tell, God would draw Sisera. So you draw your men, God will draw Sisera. Different versions use different translations here, like, but anyway, that's really what it means. It doesn't have the word men or men, man or anything, or troops even, or not in the Hebrew. It just says draw toward Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men, and there's our word. And by the way, you'll notice in many of the, and in the newer, neutered translations, men is not in there. For some reason, they take it out, but the Hebrew-ish is there. Of the sons of Naphtali and sons of Zebulun. Who goes to war anyway? Everybody? All the people?
No.
Of course not. And I think if you were reading the story as an Israelite, you know, I mean, think of it during the time of Samuel, you would never question that men were the soldiers and men killed people and men were to call other men to battle and men were to lead them down the hill into battle. And that's just the way the world was supposed to be. But in the story, we start seeing things kind of flipped over. And you've seen the first thing here in the fact that Barak is not doing what he's supposed to do. And why would it be Barak's responsibility to address Jabin ruling in Hazor? Do I have a map here? Yes, I do. I'll get to that in a minute. Let's finish. And against you, I will deploy or draw toward Sisera, draw the commander of Jabin's army with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon. And I will deliver you him into your hand. Whose hand? Deborah's hand? Whose hand? Into Barak's hand. And Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I'll go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. We can have some discussion about why he said that. Is that an act of courage or an act of cowardice? I mean, you had to put it in one category or the other. Which is it?
Well, maybe he's being kind of cowardly.
I think so. So she's already, it seems like, reproving him for not taking care of the problem in his own tribe. But also here, he kind of says, oh, I don't think I want to go unless you go along. Perhaps in the same spirit that, you know, the sons of Eli grabbed the Ark of the Covenant, and carried it into battle against the Philistines. Maybe it's a talisman, or maybe it was a, like, you know, if you're really sure this is going to happen, then you'll be willing to go along with me, right? And so in case it doesn't, you'll suffer with us. I don't understand why he required that, but it wasn't a good thing. You right? I mean, isn't it clear from what she says next that she does not think that's a good thing that he said, right? He should not have required that. But if you do, if, you know, so she says, I will go with you, surely. But nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you're taking. I love that phrase. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. We don't know at this point which woman, but then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and there's the word men again. I forgot to put it in red. And Deborah went up with him. Now, remember, up to this point, Deborah was not a traveling prophetess or judge. She sat, and people came up to her. Now, later, we'll see judges who have 30 sons who ride on 30 donkeys, and these cities are in the Transjordan area are named after Jair, for example. Havoth Jair, the villages of Jair. And it seemed like there was another one that had 30 sons and 40 grandsons or something. The sense seems to be there that there was a territory and that maybe they rode a circuit or their kids rode a circuit or something like that. So, but that's not the case. And it's only at his invitation that she follows along. All right, so here's some geography. So Deborah's court is down here in near Bethel. There's another name for it. I think it's enlisted. I forget what it is right now. But here's Kadesh way up here. And, I mean, there's Galilee. And anyway, here's Hazor. That's where Jabin leads. And then somewhere around in here is where Sisera had his chariots, we think. And then this is where the battle is. The actual poem mentions Taanach, which is right in here. And that's the Kishon River. So clearly the battle takes place right in this area. Mount Tabor's where the troops were gathered to right here. And so when Sisera is routed and he jumps out of his chariot, he runs up here to Kadesh. Meanwhile, his armies go seem to like they're going back home, wherever that is. And so that's where they're defeated as they go home. But he takes off in a real manly fashion, just running home. You know, this is another one of those, seems like there's a lot of poking fun at the men in the story. In particular, the fact that he gets out of his chariot and runs away. All right, so Sisera came. Deborah's song mentions the battle was in Taanach. I think I've covered all that. Sisera fled to Jael's tent near Zaanaim, near Kadesh, so that's way up here, trying to get up there to where Jabin was in Hazor, even though his men were headed back to where they came from, probably in the other direction. When we get into the poem, the blue tribes are the tribes that came when Barak called them, the 10,000 who gathered at Mount Tabor. And then the red ones are the ones, Asher by the sea, and Gad, and Reuben, and Dan, and they all just kind of looked the other way, or wished them well, or had great intents of heart, but just didn't do anything. So you'll see that in the story. Here's a photo of Mount Tabor. Looks like to me it's a great place for cell towers today, but anyway, it doesn't look like the best place in the world to gather an army, especially if you're trying to do it in secret. But it was probably safer to be up there than to be down in the plain, right? You see the flat area down here. Safer if there were chariots and other, the army of the enemy was gathered against you there. Here's what it looks like across the plain of Megiddo, where the battle would have been fought. So you can see you're up on the mountain. The way the battle worked is they came down the mountain, which is kind of an odd tactic if you don't have chariots or weapons of any kind, to go down into the valley where the chariots operate the best. And I'm sure Sisera was quite puzzled when they started down the hill into his, into his clutches, so to speak, into the perfect tactical advantage that he was expecting to have. So I'm going to skip ahead a little, and we'll cover this next section a little out of order, but it helps to read the explanation of the battle outcome. Did we finish reading this section right here? Yeah, we did. Okay, so here's what happened when they came down the hill, and this is from the poem. In chapter 5, Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, that seems to describe maybe something coming from the east, I think, maybe the weather. The earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds poured water, the mountains gushed before the Lord. This Sinai, now they were not at Mount Sinai, but what's the reference to Sinai? Why would he mention Sinai? What happened there? That would fit here in this battle. Everybody don't answer at once.
Marty, some, are you talking about like when God did his thing on the mountain, the Sinai?
Yeah, what kind of things did he do?
Like smoke and fire and
thunder and lightning.
Yeah, there was earthquake. And weather events, I guess. I can't remember if there was thunder or lightning, but maybe thunder. But anyway, loud noises, right? And so I think the poet here, Deborah in Barak, whoever wrote this verse, I don't know, but is making a reference to that fearful weather and fearful events in the sky that happened at Sinai. And so what I picture is a pretty terrible thunderstorm, maybe even a tornado, maybe even huge thunder and lightning, and maybe even earthquake. Who knows? But enough rain coming from the mountains, pouring down into that valley. And one thing about valley is that's where the waters collect, right? If there's and the Kishon River, of course, is taking all that water down to the sea, I think, at that point. But it just flooded, and it just filled that area. And there have been a few times, even in the last century, in which there was enough rain, unusual amount of rain, that the Kishon River did flood and actually flooded some of the nearby towns. So it happens, but it's very, very rare. That's a pretty dry area. It's all watered by irrigation. Anyway, the kings came and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. But they took no spoils of silver. They, I think that's a different they, that's probably God's forces, fought from heaven, from the heavens. The stars from their courses fought against Sisera. It's almost like this picture of the stars, even heavenly bodies are throwing down stuff on the armies there in the valley. The torrents of Kishon swept them away. That ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. I could tell you a story quickly. Well, I shouldn't. Anyway, I was driving with a guy in Israel, and he was kind of an Israeli. He was our sales rep over there. So we were driving right down through that valley. I said, now the river Kishon's around here somewhere. We should be able to see it. He said, oh, you can't see. It's just a dry creek bed. You know, it's just, so today it's very teeny and small. But at that time it was flooded, of course. My soul marched on. Then the horse's hoofs pounded, the galloping of steeds. Clearly this is poetry, but the repeating of words has a sound effect, really, of maybe, you know, picturing the battle, you know, how it would sound, not only with the thunder, but also now the horses are getting frightened, and they're stampeding, and they're running or trying to run, but the chariots are bogged down because, of course, their wheels are not made for wet, muddy areas. And so a lot of things are going wrong for Sisera, and, of course, the weather events. So I wonder if when Deborah says, go, if she's looking at the sky and thinking, I think it's just about to start that storm that I'm expecting. And so she,
well, Marty, interesting. I looked up in Exodus 16. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning and a thick cloud over the mountain. And right. There was so perfect. So maybe that was identical to what was happening. So,
but there was also earthquakes, if I remember, at Sinai.
Yes, later. But I'm saying in the morning, they already see the signs that it's going to be a flood.
Yeah, thanks for looking that up. Yeah, so that's pretty clearly what happened in the battle, and that is God helped them with what you might think of as a natural event, but certainly maybe a supernatural coincidence that Deborah told Barak to take his troops down the mountain, out of their protected area, into the valley at the very time that weather is going to occur. Did I skip that part? No, here it is. Yeah, so it just mentions here, Heber the Kenite, the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zaanaim, which is beside Kedesh. And they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, mentioned about three times in the poem that there were 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. So perfect stage set for battle. Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Lord gone out before you? So Barak went down from the mountain with 10,000 men, ish, following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots, all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot. It seems like a dumb thing to do unless your chariot's bogged in the mud, right? Can't move. And fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth and Goyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, and not a man, and that's not the word ish, interestingly, although the ESV puts man in there. I don't know why they put it in one place when it doesn't exist in the Hebrew, and they don't put it where it doesn't. The word in the Hebrew is unity or a single one, so it just means not one was left. That's kind of the way the Hebrew is there. So anyway, more details from the song. About the before and after the battle. In the days of Shamgar, and see, this is where somehow Shamgar gets associated with Deborah and Barak, so, but I don't think that means he's from, you know, Issachar or Naphtali. The highways were deserted. The travelers walked along the byways. Village life ceased in Israel. Until I, Deborah, arose, a mother in Israel. Notice she doesn't say a military general in Israel, right? A leader. You know, she just says she's a mother. And I think, as I think of a picture of what a mother does, one of the things mothers do, if they're good mothers, like Lois and Eunice, for example, is they push their children to do what they're supposed to do. Even if it's something that the mother herself may not be suited to do. And so I think it's the case that one role of women, in particular wives, is to push their husbands to be the leaders in the things that they are supposed to do, whether the wife can do it or not. And I think that's actually what you're seeing here. And it's because there were not men doing what they were supposed to do. That's pretty clear from the story. And the story itself has some humorous things about men not being what they ought to be. They chose new gods. There was war in the gates. I think that suggests a civil unrest, which may be what's happening in our country today. When there's a crisis and law is kind of suspended for a while, or maybe people are not at work like they ought to be or whatever, then you get a bunch of, you know, unrest. And there's war in the gates, and you can't even carry on normal commerce, it seems like. And not only that, not a sheer shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with the rulers of Israel, who offered themselves willingly with the people. That phrase is only found about three times in the Old Testament. And do you see in that a sacrificial picture? They offered themselves. Do you see that in that phrase? Why? But now, is this like all this, these subservient, subjective people in subjection who are offering themselves willingly? Or is it rulers? Notice that. What's shown as a virtue here is someone who offers themselves in service to others and to God, of course, in a sacrificial way. What were their chances as they sat up on the mountain looking down at 900 chariots of iron in the valley? What was likely to be the outcome if you weren't a person of faith? What would you think? And you see that even the rulers here are described as being in, you'll see that later too, in subjection to the service of Jehovah, to the good of the nation, and of course to Barak's leadership. It's an interesting image. So keep on reading, and you'll see a contrast. Now, this appears to be, in the next verses 10 through 12, a contrast. Speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit in judges' attire, which suggests the civilization restored, who walk along the road. Notice, you couldn't walk along the road. You had to go the back roads before, right? Far from the noise of the archers, from the water, the idea there is the battle's over. We don't have the noise of battle. It's peaceful now. We can go to the watering places, and we don't have to worry about the noise of battle. There, they recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers in Israel. Then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. Before there was war in the gates. Now they can have commerce. Civilization is restored. Awake, awake, Deborah, and sing a song. Awake, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. So nice poem there, describes the before and after of the society related to the battle. However, Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, where there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber and the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear. And now we're remembering the words that Deborah spoke to Barak, aren't we? That the Lord would deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. And you can kind of see the story evolving. How's this going to work? Because here's a hardened leader, military general, and here's a wife who sets up tents and lives in tents for her livelihood. And so she said, turn aside, my lord, turn aside and do not fear. He had turned aside with her in the tent. She covered him with a blanket. That's an interesting image. What do women usually cover? Who do they usually cover with blankets? I wonder.
Their children.
Yes, their children. And he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. But what did she give him instead of water?
Milk.
I wonder, what do women give? Who do they give milk to sometimes? I opened a jug of milk and gave him drink and covered him up. And he said to her, stand at the door of the tent, and if any man, now you won't find this if you read the ESV or the NIV again. I can bash them some more. But you will find it in the Old King James, the American Standard. And it says, stand at the door of the tent, and if any ish comes and inquires of you and says, is there any ish here? And so the question is kind of humorous. It's saying, is there a man in the tent? And what's she supposed to say?
No,
there's no man in here. He ran away from the battle. He's a loser, right? And he's here, and maybe there's a little boy in here with his mommy, but there's not a man, right? And that's kind of It's pretty clear in the Hebrew that that's the intent of using that word there. Because you could have used that word, is there any one? Remember that unity word we saw earlier? But no, it's emphasizing man there. And so she's, you'll say no. So no, there's no man in there in the sense that someone who's living up to his manly job or his manly image. And Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the tent peg into his temple and went down to the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said, come, I'll show you the man, the Ish, whom you see. And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with the peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel, and the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin the king until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. All right. What's the lesson of this? I think the poem that Deborah and Barak write or sing together is, it tells us what's going on. And it starts with this phrase, when leaders lead in Israel. And does that imply that they were not leading in Israel before this happened? And that that perhaps was what got them into that mess? Or maybe that was a symptom of their lack of spirituality? Or faith in God to step up men, to step up and do what they were supposed to do. And that's certainly the context in which she seems to poke, Barak and say, get going. God's commanded you to do this. And he should have known that. Perhaps he did know it and he was not stepping up to that. So when leaders lead, and that's a complicated Hebrew phrase, but it seems to be the loosing of strength is maybe the sense of it. I'm not going to go into all the details, but it's difficult to translate, but it seems to make sense. And then not only that, what's the second secret? Is people willingly offer themselves. Remember, we already read verse 9 that the rulers were offering themselves. But what makes leaders is people who are willing to sacrifice and step up to helping and serving and being selfless about it. And I know we're all looking at this, men and women's roles, through the eyes of what our culture has done to us. And that makes me angry, the way it makes us sensitive about it. We can't say out loud that men and women are different from each other, unless it's related to the Me Too movement. It seems like only the men are the abusers and the women are the victims. But we don't ever mention that. But anyway, the point is, we can't even mention that they're different. We can't say that men are better at some things than others. We can't say that women are better at some things than others. We can't say that God's given them different roles, without having this voice of the culture shouting in our ears, you know, something about how we're being abused or something. I think the self-centered generation leads one to believe that if you're not a leader, you won't get your way and you will somehow be at a disadvantage. If you start with that premise, then you believe that if you're not a leader, you're not as good or you're not in as advantageous a position. And that's what's really behind the whole thing about equality and all the roles across our culture. And it is not the case that we would argue that people are, men and women are not better at many other things from each other. And they have different roles. And God kind of made us and knows what that should be. But he's saying that the difficulty here before was leaders were not leading, and now they are. And what did it take to make a leader lead? It took a woman to push the guy to do what he was supposed to do. And that's kind of a great illustration of the roles, it seems to me. And women often, it's pretty clear to me in the Bible and in my life, have been way more spiritually minded than most of the men I know. And they give a lot better advice and they're more oriented toward noticing when people are not doing what they're supposed to do. Does that mean they should be leaders? No, I think it means they should be outspoken about it, though, and that they should say what they need to say. Am I preaching? I'm sorry. I'll back off a little bit. But if you're being offended by this, I will ask you this question, mainly because you're not in the room and you can't hit me or anything. If you're offended by this, think about where you get that offense. Is it from our culture right now? And if you lived 100 years ago or 200, would you have been offended in the same way? And why not? Was the culture different then? Maybe. I'm just asking the question to see. But anyway. And so when that happens, bless the Lord, right? The Lord will be praised because people are living up to their roles. And though, so verse 3 is a doxology. I'll sing praise to Yahweh, God of Israel. And it seems like that this condition, I didn't point it out except, I didn't point to the verse here, that this leader's leading is what enabled it. That's what happened. Somebody did the right thing. And as often the case, it's a woman that does that. and it triggered other people to do the right thing. Okay, let's keep reading. So I want to say a little bit about military leadership roles as they're pictured in the Bible. This is a passage from Isaiah chapter 3, verses 4 through 7, and it's describing the debased state of Israel. God has taken away their heroes. He's taken away their military leaders and their rulers. And instead, in their place, as part of their punishment, he gave children to be their princes and babies to rule over them, right? The people will be oppressed, everyone by another and everyone by his neighbor. So here's this same every man did what was right in his own eyes going on. The child will be insolent, debased toward the honorable. When a man takes hold of his brother in the house of his father, I like this, saying, you have clothing to be our ruler, right? So what does it take to be a ruler in this civilization? You got a nice suit you can wear? You kind of look like a good ruler? Put it on, man. You can be our ruler. And he says, well, I can't cure your ills. I don't have food or clothing. Don't make me the ruler of the people. See, nobody wants to be the ruler, right? And down in verse 12, he says, children of their oppressors and women rule over them. This is a curse, he says, because of the anarchy and the chaos in the society. Oh, my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way to your paths. And you can see the insult that comes from when a woman does a man's job in taking vengeance or in going to war in some way or another against another man. I think Teresa already mentioned this illustration. Later in Judges, we'll see that Gideon's son, Abimelech, is killed. He's attacking a city, and some clever woman just gets the round upper millstone, you know, that rolls around on the flat one, and just throws it over the side of the tower wall, I guess, and it hits him in the head. But somehow he's conscious enough to say, hey, the young man near in the armor bearer, you kill me. So nobody would say that I was killed by a woman. You see the insult that would be carried when a woman would kill a man. And even in this story, you see that same thing in what Deborah says to Barak. She's not saying that as a blessing, but really as kind of an insult that would come out of the battle. So there's chaos, I think I would say, when we try to reverse the roles, pretending that men and women have the same roles and are equally skillful in all the elements of life. And I don't know why we've convinced ourselves in this culture that that's so. I think it's a self-centered view that if you don't have your share of leadership and power, you won't get your share of the stuff, right, the goods, and someone will abuse you, which is likely true in our culture. All right, here are the descriptions of Deborah and Jael. She's a prophetess. That's a feminine form. She's the wife of Lapidoth. She judged. And interesting that in the Hebrew, it's not in all of our translations. I'm sorry, more criticism, but there's actually an unrequired but present feminine pronoun stuck into the, you know, a lot of times the verbs don't need pronouns. They have a masculine or feminine form. And it says twice it mentions a feminine pronoun and also mentions that they came up to her for judgment. She describes herself as a mother in Israel, as we've talked about. By the way, here are the two words for judgment. I mentioned that. That's the typical word for judge, and that's what she did. But also she came up, and it seems to me she had some civil role in issuing verdicts. And interesting to me in the song, the role is that Deborah break out in song, and Barak lead away your captives. Seems like an interesting description maybe of the roles that they might have in revealing what we found in that beautiful poem, but also in doing the work of the military leadership. And again, Jael is always called the wife, and then most blessed of women is described. So are Deborah and Jael, are they praised in this? Are they found in favor for what they did? Are they favored? Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's interesting that Barak and certainly Sisera, as we made fun of him, right, they don't come off looking that great. And I think maybe the point of the story is that the leaders were not leading until they were pushed into it. I think that you can see that in there. Okay, who helped? Now, I won't read all of these things, but Ephraim helped, and they had experience in the war against Amalek, apparently back at perhaps at Sinai. Remember, Benjamites, those are the special forces of Israel, left and right-handed and more warlike. Maker is probably Manasseh from over in Gilead. Y'all know where that is now. And Zebulun. Interesting that Zebulun and Issachar came with writing instruments and, and the Manasseh people were lawgivers or administrators. And you have to wonder, what were they going to do in the battle? Were they going to fight with their quill pens or something, you know, and run around stabbing people? Or what were they going to do? And I don't know, but the fact that they came with whatever skills they had, that's huge to me, right? And I think that thinking that God can only deal with strong Benjamites, left-handed warriors who have lots of weapons, which they didn't, of course, none of them did, that's wrong. God can deal with any of us. He can use us all with whatever little talents we think we have. They might be big in the service there. And so Issachar, I forgot to underline, oh, it's underlined there, was under his command, which really literally is translated at his feet. Meanwhile, among Reuben, remember over on the southeast, there were great resolves of heart, but apparently they didn't do anything. We're with you. We're praying for you. You know, we hope it works out because, boy, if it doesn't, we're in trouble. You know, but they're not going to be there for the battle. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flock? Reuben had great searchings of heart, and I wonder if sometimes when there's something going on the church is involved in and some outreach event, and we're thinking, oh, man, I got other stuff to do on Saturday. But we're with you, right? We have great resolves of heart. We're praying for you, you know, but we got stuff to tend to. Our sheep kind of deserves some attention. And, of course, Gilead. Remember, Gilead's not a tribe. Remember that. It's over on the east, and it's kind of like Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, but mainly Gad in the middle. Why did Dan remain on the ships and continue by Asher by the seashore? I forgot to mark Asher in red and stayed by the inlets. Well, you know, ships require a lot of maintenance. Y'all are aware of that, right? You can't just leave your ships to go fight a battle at the drop of a hat. You know what I mean? And you see they're condemned in this for letting these things get in the way. But contrast, Zebulun jeopardized their lives. Naphtali also. Remember, Naphtali was the home tribe of Barak, and the one where Hazor was. And then finally, this city of Miraz, no one knows where it is, and perhaps that's the curse that was named on it. It's perhaps they had a treaty with Hazor, with Jabin, and if they went to battle against him, they would be in trouble because they had allegiances that maybe others didn't know about. That's somewhat the idea, that they would have. They were already kind of committing treason and making peace with this guy. If they give him to battle, they would be exposed somehow or another. All right, we're almost done. I'm sorry to go long. There's two more women, actually more than two here, but two that you noticed that are listed in the poem. Most blessed among women is Jael, the wife of Heber. Blessed is she among the women in tents. It's great. He asked for water, but she gave him milk. Remember that? She's a mother. And she brought out curds or curdled milk, apparently, in a magnificent, that's another translation, bowl. She got the tin peg and the hammer. And then notice the poetry here. She pounded, she pierced, she split, and she struck. And at her feet, he sank, he fell, he lay still, he sank, he fell, he sank, he fell dead. I'm picturing the old-timey movies where it takes people a long time to die. You know, they got to fall over a few times and kick their feet around a little bit, roll around, and then finally they kick a few more times, and finally they're dead. So whatever happened there is pictured in the poem, I think. And then, meanwhile, back home in Harosheth Hagoyim, poor Sisera's mother, another mother, but not in Israel, was looking through the window and cried out through the lattice, "Why is his chariot so long as coming? Why carries the clatter of the chariots?" Her wisest ladies answered her. Yes, she answered herself. Are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two, right? For Sisera, again, the irony that he's not taking advantage of women, which, by the way, is, you know, that would be the fate, you know, if Israel had not conquered. Or two, right? For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments, plunder of garments embroidered with dye. Maybe he would be bringing back as a present back to her, of course, as his mom. Two pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the leader. And so that's her kind of funny ending to the story, that they're expecting Sisera to come back victorious, and just the opposite has happened. Instead of him taking advantage of women, he's been killed by a woman after the battle. And thus, let all your enemies perish, Deborah ends by saying. Yeah, that let that be the fate. Let all the enemies of Jehovah be killed by women. You know, I think that's kind of, we saw the shame of that earlier. Let them all perish that same way. Let those who love him, though, be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. And I think the image of the sun coming up that ends the poem is a picture of when leaders leave. when the beginning of the beginning starts. And that's kind of the way that language is in verse 2 or 3. Sorry I've taken so long. But I think the poem ends with the same emergence of the light, really, of goodness, of truth, of the right things, as the poem begins with back in, I guess it's verse 3, where it says when leaders live. All right? Isn't that a fun story? Interesting details. Okay, does anybody want to argue with me about any of this?
Marty, I just, sir, I made the quote that that section there, 24 to 27, that Phil Roberts always read that with great gusto. You really got it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was like we don't have photographs from Bible times, but that's about as close as we get to a moving picture, really, of Sisera's death, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Too bad Nate wasn't there to capture the actual imagery. So, Nate, I think that would be a great – I noticed you Shamgar was pretty violent in those illustrations. Maybe you could give us some pictures of Sisera's death. You got one? Or is that in your book? I should have looked.
I've got Abimelech's death. I don't have Sisera, though.
Oh, man, you got to get Sisera in there.
Yeah.
Well, I'll dig that out for the class on the Abimelech, Gideon and Abimelech.
Maybe that's what the guys with their writing implements were doing.
That's it. That's right. They were drawing pictures of the battle.
Right.
Thought that they might have been message carriers, or they might have, kept a census, and that's how we knew who showed up, and that they could be given credit in the poem or whatever. But yeah, something like that.
Marty, one of my grandsons drew that picture for me with J.L. and Sisera, and his headline was, "She nailed it." I have cherished that picture. She nailed it.
So I wouldn't have thought before, but just looking at it and reading a few things, I really think that there is humor in this story. I hope you could see some of that in the role reversals and the unexpected twists and in the role that women end up playing, often doing the job of men. And I think, unfortunately, throughout Bible history and in my own life, there's the occasion where women have to step up and do the job of men. And that's not the ideal, of course, but sometimes it's necessary. But for sure, the example of Deborah pushing, supporting, comforting, in the sense of the comforter that I think, who's doing the lessons on that, fortifying, I think Bill has been emphasizing that word comfort used to mean fortify, F-O-R-T, like, fortify or get your fort or, whatever. That is going with him, stand behind him. Yeah, sure, it's going to be okay. Just do it. And God's told you to do it. Anyway. Okay. Had enough? I've gone way over. I'm setting a bad precedent. I'll watch the participant numbers decline as we go from lesson to lesson. If I keep going along, but I don't know what else y'all have to do. But,
Thank you, Marty.
Okay.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Marty.
You nailed it, Marty.
No, thanks.